Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
Welcome to Local Food Connections, a show about the power of locally grown food to connect us more strongly with our communities and the lands we inhabit. The show promotes sustainable food systems that foster community resilience and empower individuals to make positive choices for themselves, their communities, and the environment. Local Food Connections is brought to you by Local Food Connect. We're broadcasting from Wurundjeri country and pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging. We respect the enduring strength of First Nations people and acknowledge their long heritage of agriculture and care for the land on which we live. On today's show, I'm pleased to be chatting with Fuchsia. Fuchsia has a background in horticulture and landscape design. She's a permaculture enthusiast. She's based in Benalla in northeastern Victoria. Fuchsia is interested in permaculture, community resilience and practical permaculture techniques. And she has published in Renew magazine and more recently contributed to the Local Food Connect newsletter, which is where I first came into contact with her. So today we're actually going to chat a little bit about what's involved in permaculture training. So welcome, Fuchsia.
G'day.
So tell us where you are right now.
I am sitting on the swollen banks of the Broken River. It's very wet and soggy out there. And I'm on Yorta Yorta, Tangarang and Bangarang country, in between the river and the high country.
And what sort of land are you on?
It's beautiful land. It's so productive, and these floods have been going on for a really long time. Ironbark forest, lots of rivers, lots of little creeks. It's beautiful country. Agriculturally, we have a bunch of different, we've got a bit of cattle, a bit of sheep, a bit of grain crops, a lot of solar farms these days as well, popping up everywhere like sunflowers. It's pretty welcoming land.
And how much of it are you sitting on?
I'm on a pretty big country block. I rent, so it's not mine. But I need binoculars to see the back of my back fence.
That's interesting that you rent, because a lot of the listeners will be renters too, but interested in permaculture. Tell me about what permaculture practice you're able to do in that context.
Well, it's the million-dollar question, quite literally, isn't it? It cramps my style, quite honestly. For many, many years, all I wanted to do is just put down some roots and plant a garden and watch it grow. And because in order to practice it, you do need access to land. And it's easier said than done, isn't it? My horticultural practice, the very first plants I grew were literally pots on the roof of the garage downstairs. I would climb out the window of the spare room onto the roof of the garage in the Blue Mountains where I was living at the time. And I had my collection of pot plants out there because I was living in a flat, and that was the only way I could really do it. The balcony, I had a balcony, but it was Blue Mountains, really, really dark and cold. I've gone from those humble beginnings to, you know, having big suburban blocks, totally overhauling them, doing perma blitzes, and then reeling it all back in when that went pear-shaped, and going back to pot plants. I recently moved house, and my poor removalist looked at my 120 pot plants and almost had a conniption fit, which I can't blame him. But you just got to kind of roll with it, what you can.
Yep. Tell me what a permablitz is, for those who don't know.
A permablitz is like a crowdsourced working bee focused on permaculture. So it's kind of, in some ways, counterintuitive to the start small tenet of permaculture. Small and slow solutions is one of the one of the principles. But a lot of people simply won't be able to put the systems in place in relationship to each other without a big push at the start. So there are definitely arguments for doing a perma-blitz, and I thought mine was fantastic. It was great. But there's also arguments against. So what will typically happen with a perma-blitz is a bunch of people come together and overhaul someone's backyard. You'll go to a few perma-blitzes yourself before you can put your hand up for maybe being a recipient of one. And so that gives you a chance to learn what it's all about, connect with other like-minded souls, get hands in the dirt, get some work done. Often the designs are donated by up-and-coming designers, as it was in my case. I found it a really fulfilling experience on a number of different levels, and it really kick-started not only my garden but my own interests. And it was not long after that that I actually started my formal training.
So there's that idea in permaculture of, as you say, small and slow solutions, and don't jump into things, observe first. And also, I think it's probably Bill Mollison, I think, who used to say, just start at your back door. But on the other hand, it also says design, design it properly at the beginning, or not really
That's
properly,
right.
but it's sort of design it, keep, well, you tell me, when you start to design your garden, what sort of things are you supposed to be thinking about before you jump
Well,
in?
the key word is design. If it's not designed, I've had a lot of people say to me, I want to grow organic veggies, I want to have a pond, I want to have chickens, I want to have this, I want to have that. I want to have a permaculture garden. And yeah, it can absolutely be a permaculture garden, but unless you're thinking about the relationships between those different what we would call design elements, then and how they relate to each other, how they interact with each other, how they support each other, how they minimize the input, the time, the effort you're going to need to put in to get what you want out, which we call yields, but you can call whatever you want, your output. Then is it really permaculture? Well, maybe, maybe not. So the planning element is really, really important, and it doesn't have to be anything fancy. You don't have to have any particular qualifications. You just have to be willing to learn and observe. And it all starts with looking. It all starts with really taking it in. And in this day and age where there's phenomena such as plant blindness, where people can look at a plant and literally not even see it, this is a thing. This is an actual studied, real thing. Because many of us, unfortunately, for one reason or another, have become so divorced from nature. So we really need to, in order to garden better, to get more out of it, to put less into it, for it to be more satisfying, more successes, less failures. We need to really tap into that environment. And if we haven't had the chance to do that before, it might feel a little bit forced at the start, or a little bit like, yeah, something you have to consciously work towards or think of. But like anything else, it's just practice. And once you get into the habit of it, you'll notice all sorts of things that were going on right under your nose. And I think that for me, that was one of the things that permaculture has really helped to teach me. I was lucky because as you probably guessed from my name, I did come from a family of plant obsessed people, plant nerds. So that was kind of in my blood a bit, but it's something we can all cultivate.
And I think the whole thing with a permablitz, for example, is that it's that idea of community resilience. Like, you might have the eyes to see certain things in your garden, but if you've got 10 people in there for a day, they might be able to say, "Oh no, don't plant it there. Can you see the shade for that from that tree?" Or, "Don't plant it there. The house is going to overshadow that at about 3 o'clock this afternoon."
100%.
Yeah. So,
100%. And also, it's worth mentioning too that at the other end, when you've got a beautiful permaculture productive garden going, it's going to create a abundance. It's going to create a lot of stuff, whether that's eggs or, you're going to need people to share that 100 kilos of apricots, or that all come at once over a 2 week period, or all the eggs that you can't possibly get through and can't really freeze, and stuff like that. So it's very much a give and take. But yeah, community permaculture is not just about gardening. It is really a design philosophy, and it's a very holistic way of looking at things. So to not have people, community in that equation would be to do yourself and your community a disservice, really.
It's funny that when I did a PGC, we got taken to visit a just a local woman who had a quarter acre block, and she said her biggest problem, because she'd done it so well, she didn't put it this way, she didn't say I've done it so well, but it was clear that she had her biggest problem was the harvest,
Yeah.
how to cope with the amount of abundance of it. Amazing.
Worst problems to have, let's face it.
Oh, she
The
had.
struggle is real.
She had beautiful land up in Montrose, up in the Dandenong, so thick old, soil. All right. So tell me about your, you said you trained in horticulture, traditional horticulture or conventional horticulture and landscape gardening. How do you see the move into permaculture? What happened with you? Why do you now say I'm a permaculture
Well,
practitioner?
it's actually the other way around.
Oh, okay.
I studied permaculture first, and then I wanted to just go deeper, so much deeper. So I di actually did my PDC first, and then a Cert 3 in permaculture, and then horticulture training at TAFE and landscape design training. And I think, that for me, the most enlightening way to go about it is to take what you want and what works for you from whatever, label you want, and then incorporate what works. You don't have to incorporate what doesn't work for you. Labels are just labels at the end of the day. I found it quite useful for me to know the rules if I was going to break them.
The rules of horticulture is laid down
Yeah,
from the history of that practice.
that's right. So in permaculture, we're probably not huge on lawns. They have their place. Not saying that definitely don't have a lawn, but can you maybe use that space more productively? You're spending all this time mowing it. Some people even fertilize it and aerate it and all the rest of it. We spend a lot of time in our lawns to have them, and some people make good use of them too, with kids can run around or dogs or what have you. But for others, they just make no sense at all. But I got a lot out of learning how to care for a lawn, so that if people want it, I can guide them towards that. If people don't, well, then let's get rid of it and plant some veggies. Pesticides as well, pesticides and herbicides. I found it personally really useful to actually learn how to use those, use them effectively. It's something that would absolutely be a last resort for me, but knowing what's available and knowing where there's the edge case every now and then where it's appropriate to have that knowledge, I found really useful. If you've got a patch of blackberries in the forest and you've got to take a bulldozer in there and destroy the joint just to get them out, would it in that case actually be more effective to just use a tiny bit of very targeted poison, job done, let the land regrow? So I'm not a super purist, and so I guess for that reason it was good to be able to get the conventional training and then reject most of it, keep a few things that are handy every now and then.
Of course, a permaculturalist would say get a goat for the black, but if you
Yeah.
haven't, in the absence of a goat, maybe a little bit of herbicide.
Yeah, in the middle of the bush, would you
Oh.
take a goat? I mean, they're going to stomp on all the native orchids. They're not native. They don't belong there. So yeah, they definitely have their place. I would much prefer to be looking at a goat than a bottle of pesticide, but yeah, it's all about assessing, and this is where the observation comes in once again. If you're really tapped in, let the land speak to you, tell you what it needs, then you're more likely to be able to make more informed decisions.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I think there's a permaculture principle, what accept feedback. Is it?
Yeah, absolutely.
And if you're doing what if you're doing something that the that's so-called some kind of purist permaculture thing and it's not working, then there's no point in doing it just because it comes under the banner of permaculture.
Yeah.
You've just got
Yeah.
to accept the feedback that you're getting from nature that this
Yeah.
is not working or, you know.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Absolutely. And of course you've got to obtain a yield, so there's no point in going, oh, it's very pure and I don't use
Yeah.
it, but whatever, but you don't have any yield either because
100%.
things eat and everything.
Australia's energy market is broken.
Right, but CoPower gives you better energy?
Nope, no retailer can control where the electrons they buy off the grid come from. But as a CoPower member, you can vote on where 100% of revenue goes. So instead of corporate profit, your energy bill builds the world you want to be a part of.
That's cool.
Learn more about the solidarity economy and CoPower today and take the power back.
Victorian energy fact sheets and basic plan information documents are available at cooperativepower.org.au. For clear advice on the right plan for you, contact us on 03 9068 6036.
A 3CR supporter.
Fuchsia, why don't we talk now about permaculture design certificates? So, without talking about any particular one that you did, and I know you did one as a cert for at a TAFE, what do we learn in a permaculture design certificate?
It's a good grounding. So your typical permaculture design certificate is generally about 100 hours, 120 hours or thereabouts. They do vary quite widely because they're unregulated. You're going to get an overview of what permaculture is. They're probably going to touch on some techniques, specific techniques that are associated with the movement or the philosophy. They would ground you in the principles, recommend relevant further reading, which there's a lot these days, which is great. Lots of fantastic books out there, YouTubers, practitioners all over the world. Some places it's even taught in schools these days. And so you're going to get that basic grounding, and probably if you're keen and you enjoy it and you relate, you find it engaging, you'll springboard off from there in the directions that most interest you. And for some people, that might be urban permaculture. For others, it will be more broadacre stuff. So there's a lot of leeway for you to find what you're really interested in and go off and explore that.
So you made a distinction there between the principles and the techniques. So I wonder if we could actually, why don't we talk about some techniques and then talk about what principles are underlying that technique? And a lot of these techniques are now they've sort of come out of permaculture and they're now sort of in the mainstream anyway. So
Yeah,
someone
that's
like
right.
someone you hear a lot, there's a few permaculture people on Gardening Australia, for instance. So tell me, say I take a so-called permaculture technique like sheet mulching. Can
Yeah.
you tell us what that is and
Oh,
what the theory behind it is?
I absolutely love sheet mulching. It's one of my favorite techniques. If you are unfortunate enough to stumble across me at a dinner party, I will sit there and talk about sheet mulching until you really like giving other people side eye and signaling silently to your partner to be saved from the conversation. It's just so simple, so affordable, so effective, and it solves a really common problem. And it's just elegant. It's ugly as hell to begin with to look at, but it's such an elegant solution. I'm actually sheet mulching right now as we speak.
Well, not exactly, because I can see that you're sitting at on a chair, but outside your door, maybe.
Yeah.
Okay,
Yeah.
what does
Well,
it look?
I recently moved house, so I had a bunch of cardboard boxes, and that's just like a red flag to a bull for a permaculture practitioner. So sheet mulching is a really simple way to deal with weeds, to deal with a patch of unwanted weeds or lawn or it's whatever you don't want, and then replace it with what you do want. So essentially, you're going to grab a bunch of cardboard or newspaper, or sometimes I use bills that people send me that I don't want to pay. No, just kidding. But you want paper, you can use carpet as long as it's pure wool, including the any seams, and it hasn't got,
Cotton, or bits of cotton stuff as well you can use.
theoretically, as long as the seams aren't polyester, and as long as there's no glue involved. Depends how pure you want to be about it, but the easiest thing I found is to get hold of cardboard boxes because you can generally scavenge them from the back of Chemist Warehouse or Bunnings or whatever. There's lots of different places that'll just have them out the back in the skip bin. They're safely and easily accessible. You can get as many as you want, whatever time of day or night that you want, and just it's an endless supply. And they're typically quite happy to get rid of them too because they pay for someone to come and cart them away. So you're going to lay them down on the ground, mow. If it's a flat bit of ground, you'll mow it down as low as you can first, and lay the newspaper or cardboard down with generous overlaps. So the idea is to smother the weeds. They can't get sun, they can't photosynthesize, their days are numbered. And you're probably thinking, well, that's going to look awful. I don't want to look at that out my kitchen window. But you cover it up with your choice of mulch, dealer's choice. Could be wood chips, could be straw, could be. I'm using autumn leaves at the moment because they were free and easily accessible, and the trees basically delivered them right to my doorstep. And so then you can't see the cardboard. And so the combination of the cardboard or whatever you use and the mulch on top basically starves the underlying weeds of what they need. But it still allows air to penetrate, unlike my mortal enemy, the black landscaping plastic and weed mat, which don't even get me started. And they still allow water through. So where the black plastic and that horrible black landscaping fabric, weed matting, where you put them down, they don't work for starters. You'll get weeds coming up through them. But secondly, you're going to just kill all your soil life or make it really, really hard for them because they're not getting air, they're baking, they're solarizing, they're really suffering under there. Whereas if you use the sheet mulching technique, it actually encourages worm activity, it encourages your invertebrates, it encourages soil life and microbiology, which is so important because those guys are going to do a bunch of hard work for you. And so the weeds die back under there, and weeds, we love them or hate them, but they are very good little pioneers and they are excellent at getting whatever they can out of the soil and putting it to good use. So they generally contain, their green matter contains quite a lot of nutrients, especially nitrogen. And so as they die down, and combine with the cardboard, you've got a really good mix of nitrogen and carbon, which is fundamental building blocks of your composting systems. The worms aren't dumb. They know that if they're munching up towards the surface of the soil, they're going to be predated on by birds. They're a lot more vulnerable to whatever's going around that wants to come and eat them. And so they'll tend to stay lower down. But when they're covered up with a nice, comfy, cozy layer of cardboard, they've got their nice blanket on, they'll come up to the surface of the soil. Meanwhile, you've got all the weeds rotting down, which are very high in nutrients. So the worms are going, yum, 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 we'll eat all these weeds. And then they crawl back down into soil, open up the soil with their little trails, leave their little manures behind, and you've turned what was a bunch of really unmanageable, ugly, potentially environmentally unsuitable weeds into beautiful soil. And then at that point, you can either just leave it like that if you want to. And it's going to be pretty low maintenance. You might need to top up the mulch every so often, depending on what kind of mulch you use. Might be once a year, might be every 6 months, depending on how quickly it breaks down. Or alternatively, you could just use a very light scatter mulch and actually sprinkle soil on top and then plant seed straight into that, like a green manure, for example. And then that'll go on to further improve your soil. And then further down the track, gives you time, buys you time to work out whatever you're going to do with that patch. Or another option is you can just plant straight into it at that point. which is what I'm doing here at the moment. I've got a bunch of tube stock, local native indigenous tube stock from a local nursery. They're $4 each. The one in Melbourne that I used to use all the time was VINC, Victorian Indigenous Nurseries Cooperative. Fantastic people doing really important work. You can get very affordable tube stock there. And so, yeah, I'm just converting a patch of what was mallow, like waist high, super happy, vibrant mallow, but not necessarily very useful,
Very good to
into.
eat. Very good to eat.
Pardon?
Very good to eat.
Oh,
If you do
not that very good. I know it's edible, but
it.
I'm not making pesto out of it or anything. But I'm converting it basically to pollinator friendly, bird friendly, bee friendly, low maintenance. It'll just sit there. It'll be their local indigenous plants. They're not going to need a lot of water. I planted lots of ground covers, so yes, I will need to top up the mulch for a while, but eventually the ground covers will take over that weed suppression, and problem solved. Once it's established, I won't need to water it, I won't need to pay the mower guy to mow it, I won't need to mow it myself. There are some finer points, if you wanted to read more about it, but it's really very simple, and once you've done it once or twice, it'll make sense to you. And now's a good time of year to do it. Really good time of year to do it because lots of rain, the cardboard gets wet. You should wet it down first before you put it down anyway. But it sits really nice and flat to the ground and breaks down quickly, and plants get a good start to establish. It's not too hot, plenty of rain at the moment. So yeah, I see what I mean?
I know. Well, I'm looking at the time, and do you know how many minutes we've got left? Two. So this is crazy. But can you do that? Was so beautifully described. It makes me actually want to run out and sheet mulch something. But it reminds me of how I sometimes feel about compost. I really love compost, and you mentioned nitrogen and carbon. Can you just do a 2-minute rant about the nitrogen and carbon balance in a healthy compost pile, please?
Sure. So carbon, building blocks of life. When we're looking to make compost, we're generally talking about brown things of carbon. If it's dry and it's brown, like dry lawn clippings or wood chips or autumn leaves or the cardboard, that's all primarily carbon. And you want a lot more of that. That's like the bread in the sandwich. And the nitrogen-rich materials that you want to balance it out with is more like the filling in the sandwich, like your lettuce. So if it's green, it can be weeds, it can be green lawn clippings, it can be trimmings, fresh twigs, anything like that, veggie scraps, that's going to be more rich in nitrogen. And ideally, it's not an exact science, honestly. You can really play it by ear, but ideally, you're looking for a lot more carbon than you are nitrogen. You can get away with quite a little bit of nitrogen. So let's say you had a pile of dry lawn clippings. If you mixed in maybe a third, around about a third of veggie scraps or something similar, you're going to end up with pretty good balance.
And Beth, what are you gonna see in the compost heap if you know that it's going well?
Well, there's hot composting and cold composting. Cold composting is primarily going to be carried out by invertebrates, worms, that sort of stuff. And your hot composting is primarily going to be carried out by aerobic bacteria. So they're quite different processes. Both are awesome. But yeah, it's just a matter of how much effort you want to put in, what ingredients you want to put in, what your infrastructure is, and just finding out what works for you.
Well, that's all we've got time for. Will you come on our show again, Fuchsia?
I'd love to.
Okay, fantastic. So this has been the Local Food Connection show on 3CR, and we've been speaking with Fuchsia, but we didn't have enough time to speak about her more with her about all the stuff she knows. So we do have to go until next week. Love the land you're on, share your surplus, and take care of each other. Remember, if you want to support independent media, you can become a 3CR subscriber. Stay tuned now to 3CR for more radical radio with Latin American Update. Bye for now.
We've been looking up, we've been messing around, we've been freaking out, but it's time to get down.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.